we at the Nasty Woman Club pay our respects to the traditional custodians of the Meanjin land. We acknowledge that we are on the stolen lands of the Yarraga and Turrbal people, whose sovereignty was never ceded. This land is, and always will be, Aboriginal land. This episode of the Nasty Woman Club podcast contains discussions around domestic violence. If these conversations are triggering, please contact 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-RESPECT. Hello everyone and welcome to the Nasty Woman Club podcast, your go-to platform for all things intersectional feminism, or as I like to call it, ScoMo's worst nightmare. Those of you that are new to the show, I'm your host Demi Lynch, and those of you that are regulars, welcome back. Thank you for tuning in again to the podcast. On today's episode of the show, I will be speaking with Tarang Chawla. I have been a fan, a follower of Tarang for quite a long time now. For years, I've admired his career, his work, his advocacy, and I've admittedly have been planning out this interview way before I even asked him to be on the show. For those of you that may be confused with this, people that may know me, people that know me well, know that far too often I will delay sending out interview requests to people that I admire because I fear that they're either too busy, they'll reject me, or worse of all, they'll ghost me. So to have Tarang instantly reply to my interview request with an, "Oh my god, I would be honored," that response just instantaneously made my career, made my year. Like, to have someone that you admire so much, that you appreciate so much for the incredible work that they do for women across the country, to have them just say, "I would be honored," that's just, yeah, mind-blowing, honestly. So I'm just gonna get right into the interview, honestly, because I just want you to all hear me attempting try not to fangirl, which I think I did successfully. Obviously not so much now. But anyway, I really hope you enjoy my chat today and enjoy me trying not to be a nervous wreck. This is Tarang Chawla. Thank you so much for coming onto today's podcast today. I really do appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Demi. Thanks for having me on.
I've been actually wanting to message you for a really, really long time to get you on a podcast, I have to admit. But I just keep thinking like, no. He has a lot of stuff to do. Because like, I've just been a fan of your work for God knows how long. I think ever since I started my platform. So it's a really big deal for you to be here. So just big, big thank you.
No, thank you. I've got such a... profound respect and admiration for everything that you put out into the world, and particularly the stuff that I get to follow on social media and see. We're in different states, so we've never actually met in person, but it's lovely to be able to talk to you today. And also thank you for everything that you put out there and all that you've done. Like, I've learned so much from Nasty Woman Club, and I'm consistently learning and being exposed to things that make me reflect and question and understand. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. So we're going to get right into it with this podcast because we do have a lot to talk about. And I think the first question I really want to ask you, this has been something that I have been wondering, is you yourself, you're a man, you are a big activist and advocate regarding violence against women. And the sad reality is we do not have many men out there that do what you do. I wish we did. I wish I could just be like, oh yeah, he's just, just another activist that, calls out violence against women and issues about that. But there really isn't a lot.
Mm.
I know it's a big question, but in your personal experience, how can we change this? How can we change this that more men can be part of this important conversation?
Oh, that's such a phenomenal question. I mean, I have to answer that, Demi, by giving context to why I started doing it in the first place. And I spoke out in a public capacity following the murder of my little sister, Nikki. That was the catalyst by which a lot of the ideas that I hold and the sort of ideologies that I was raised in and the family environment that was cultivated by my parents, a lot of that was put on a public platform following Nikki's murder. You know, I grew up in a very gender equal household, more or less, particularly given, you know, South Asian background, where there are certain ethnocultural things that get brought up in conversation around treatment or mistreatment of women generally, or any other minorities. And so it was following Nikki's murder that I spoke out about it without any semblance of a plan or without any semblance of an idea of where it would end up or that it would become such a defining pivotal moment for me to speak out about. And so I think one of the things around why men aren't as actively engaged is that collectively men, and myself included in this, we don't always recognize or understand how remarkably different the lived experience of women is. You know, it's very difficult to be what you can't see or be what you can't understand. And I think that works both ways. I think that works for women and people of all genders feeling included and seen and represented appropriately and adequately in the mainstream. But I think it also works the other way, that men aren't given or offered or supported to adopt ideas of manhood and speaking out that don't fit the norm. You know, that men are conditioned, boys are conditioned, I should say, from a very young age that you don't, quote unquote, dog the boys. You don't do things that make other people question your masculinity, question your heteronormativity, or in any way make you associated with anything other than the dominant paradigm of what it means to be a man. And I think that a lot of the work that's being done now is regrettably still done in that rubric or that framework. That is the lens by which a lot of stuff is done. And what I mean by that is, like, even when we talk about things like men's mental health, we do so often from a lens of like maintaining the hypermasculine idea of manhood. You know, we I think what we need to see to get men involved is greater opportunities and affordances for boys to express the full gamut of human emotion. And I think the more that we see and condition that behavior and normalize that, that boys are as diverse an identity as other groups can be, the more I think we'll see boys grow into men that find it comfortable to talk about these things. Because I think, and I have to put a very big caveat on what I'm about to say, I think that the world is genuinely unsafer for women and other groups. But I think that the world is not safe for men who defy the norms of what it means to be a quote unquote stereotypical male. And I think the more that we make progress towards that, the more we will see boys talking about issues that affect women and people of all genders. I think we're starting to make that leap when it comes to boys opening up about mental health and those sorts of challenges around, say, substance abuse or misuse. Those things are sort of, we're getting our head around it as a community, particularly in the West, that like, hey, we can, you know, we can talk about this. But I don't think we're getting to the point where we're creating an environment where boys are having conversations about how their lived experience differs from girls and women, right? And how they can be part of the conversation to solve some of the problems that are the product of boys, you know, boys' entitlement and men's privilege.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in your own personal experience then, because as you said, when you first spoke up about Nikki's murder, what was then the reaction then with the men in your life, like from, you know, your close relatives to even the strangers on the internet or, you know, acquaintances and friends? Like, what was the men's reaction then to you doing this? Because, yeah, as you said, like, it is, there's just not that much, that the conversation's not being had around men right now. What was their reaction to when you were bringing this conversation to topic?
Oh, what a great question. I think there was a mix of probably emotions around it. I know from like my, you know, from the, my parents, from dad in particular, he's a very quiet, considered man, you know, like he wouldn't have taken the path that I took. His way of dealing with Nikki's murder was different to mine. Yeah, and I think that for me, speaking out was part of my own handling of grief and part of my, like, you know, healing process. And the reaction was mixed. You know, there were people who I could tell, you know, in wider groups, not in my immediate family or even my extended family, but just the wider groups, that like there were people with whom I developed stronger relationships, male to male relationships, because we had like-minded views on the patriarchy, misogynistic thinking, sexism. And then there were other men in my life with whom I sort of lost touch. And, you know, 7 years now since Nikki's murder, I can adopt a degree of hindsight and reflect that it wasn't just luck or chance that those falling out kind of experiences happened. It was a product of different viewpoints on the role of women in society or gender relations, things like that. So the response was really mixed in the best possible way. It sort of affirmed to me what kind of men I want to spend more time with and what kind of man I would like to be, you know, because I'm very conscious when having this conversation that I adopt a degree of privilege. You know, I'm a man in a society that whereby men are privileged. I also have other things. I'm university educated. I am tall. I, you know, all of these things matter. I'm a man of color. That sort of, you know, changes things a little bit. I also have a name that's not like Tom or Matthew, you know, and I come from a migrant background. So there's lots of different kind of things. And that's why I think intersectionality is so important, you know, as a general concept, because it's like we have to be able to see the individual and all of the unique characteristics that make them up and then understand how privilege and discrimination impact on them, you know, so that we can actually make policies that support people. We can actually live in a society where a community is advantaged by people's unique characteristics being brought to the fore rather than being something that is too difficult to deal with or lumped in the too hard basket. And this whole experience, like, you know, first Nikki losing her life or having her life taken from her, but then seeing how men around, you know, me in all capacities, whether family or extended family or just, you know, acquaintances, it was a really interesting excursion into how a lot of men think about women, men, people of all genders, and how they sort of look at the world without them having to tell me, without them having to say anything. You know, it was really like, it really brought to the fore that when we talk about concepts like victim blaming, for example, they don't happen out in the ether. They're not something over there. They're things that people in our lives actively think, even if they're not expressing it.
I think it's just really great what you're doing. That's because these conversations with men, they need to start being had. And I still find it so interesting because we have so many well-known advocates out there that have been calling out violence against women, abuse from, you know, Grace Tame, Brittany Higgins and Chanel Contos. And there is still, and obviously there also is an issue as well. I've spoke about this previously about how there's still little women of color, obviously, in the part of those conversations at the forefront. But there's just limited men that are calling out. Do you think men also seem like it is still a women's issue that they don't, that they will, because you know how there's so much of this cancel culture that we live in right now, which there's obviously pros and cons to it. Do you feel like men are concerned that what they say is wrong, so they'd rather be quiet and not say it? Like, how do I say it? They would rather not say anything than say something and then get cancelled or get called out for what they say. If that makes sense at all, what I just said at all.
Yeah, no. I think, excuse me. I think that's a really good question. I think I can answer this in two parts. Firstly, I think that there are definitely women of color who've been campaigning since forever. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the sad realities of life in Australia is systemic, institutionalized, ingrained racist attitudes, you know, primarily beginning with attitudes towards First Nations women and then going on from there. So there are brilliant First Nations women who've been campaigning. There are women of color, there are migrant women who have been campaigning since before all of the names that you mentioned, you know, but they don't get the due deference and they don't get on the front page of newspapers. And to the credit of all of those three campaigners that you mentioned in Grace, Brittany, and Grace Tame, Brittany Higgins, and Chanel Contos, is that all three acknowledge that women of color are so crucial, migrant women, women from diverse backgrounds, women with disabilities, LGBTQIA plus community, all sort of factor into our response around inequalities and men's violence primarily. And so I think, you know, they, I like that they do that because I think that they are in a position where people will listen to them. You know, and so, for example, Chanel Contos, when she speaks about being from a privileged background of going to a wealthy private school in Sydney, I think it puts into context that that she acknowledges where she's from, and then she speaks about how other people don't get the opportunity to be seen or heard or valued in the same way. And I think that's really important. I think it's really important that they recognize that, because I think there have been campaigners in previous years who haven't necessarily recognized that we all have degrees of privilege and discrimination, you know, and I think it's interesting because, and this goes to the second point of my response around men, is that I don't see having privilege as necessarily a bad thing. You know, like we all have degrees of privilege and disadvantage. It's more what one does with the privilege that I think is most important. You know, like say, for example, if you are born and you get the opportunity of having a brilliant education, whether through the public system or the private system, whatever, right? And then you go on to say university or, you know, TAFE or higher education, and you get to do something like a profession or a vocation that you like. And then you, and it comes with certain privileges. That's not a bad thing in and of itself, right? But if you then use that to harm other people, you know, or to discriminate against other people, or to engage in practices that diminish or downplay other people's contributions to society, that's, you know, that's the reckless behavior, or that's the negligence, or that's what's harmful to people. But necessarily having privilege isn't a bad thing in and of itself. And I think that's something around the position that men occupy when it comes to this conversation is, firstly, I think, there are men who are afraid of speaking out because they're fearful of being cancelled or doing the wrong thing or saying the wrong thing. But I think that that's the minority. I think the majority of men don't speak about this because they are not necessarily totally cognizant of how systemic the issue is. You know, often we think of, you know, as men, I say we will often be conditioned to think of violence against women as, you know, men who spike women's drinks, who commit acts of extreme sexual violence, like rape, right? Murder. We think of like the true crime end of the spectrum of violence against women, but we don't think of the harassment, the discrimination, the catcalling, the gender pay gap. We don't think of those issues as having any bearing on our lives or our degree of complicity in the system that enables that. And I think that prevents a lot of men from speaking out because there's a lack of awareness and education. I think the fear of being cancelled is in the minority because most people aren't in a position to be cancelled. You know, the cancelling occurs, if it does at all, of people in positions of power. Then you have football players who have, you know, credible allegations of sexual violence brought against them, some of whom, you know, have their day in court and are found guilty of whatever they're charged with. And yet they continue to occupy front and center in mainstream Australia. And they're all generally straight white men who are very good at sport. Mm-hmm. You know, and that, I think, you know, I for one don't like the idea of cancel culture at all. I think it's redundant because it doesn't allow for the part of the human experience that is learning and growing. You know, like I grew up in a time where not everything was on the internet. You know, like I remember playing around as a kid, and I worry about children now in the sense of like if everything is documented and can be then taken out of context later to harm a child's growth or development, all in the name of like cancel culture, how would they really benefit from that? I support accountability. And I think that if someone does something that is harmful to other people and they are then held accountable for their actions, I don't see an issue with that. I don't see a lot of people who should be held accountable being held accountable. You know, so for example, there are musicians. There are musicians who continue to release music. And I'm thinking of Chris Brown. And everyone seems fine with Chris Brown or others. And no one even talks about the fact that there is no question that he did all of the things against Rihanna and others that he's been accused of. And yet people just seem to be like, oh, yeah, we don't even talk about that. And the conversation that I would like to see, which is because I think cancel culture is not going to get us anywhere, because ultimately we'll just be like, every single second person will be like, oh, we're canceling so-and-so because of something from 5 years ago. The conversation I would love to see is people we love and admire, or whose music we listen to, or whose art we consume, can and do and have done horrible things. You know, like that conversation, I think, would be far more fruitful and beneficial, because it would take away this understanding that has for too long dominated mainstream discourse around men's violence, which is that it's other men doing it. You know, it's like it's monsters or horrible men. It's not everyday men, or it's not even exemplary men. You know, like, let's use a Chris Brown example, right? Because I brought that up. Is on all accounts, he seems pretty talented, right? Like, he can sing, he can dance, he's an entertainer. He seems very good at what he does. And certainly there's a public appetite for what he does because he's successful, right? But he also did these horrible things. And yet we don't even have that conversation where it's like, it's either cancel him, right? Or it's like, ignore it. And it's like, where's the conversation that's like, this dude needs to be put into some kind of program or help so that he does not do something that will irreparably harm a woman, as he probably already has done so for some women. You know, like, where's the conversation around having that process in place so that men are supported? And I think that we need to have this conversation, because otherwise we're going to continue this line of thinking that violence against women happens at the extreme end of the spectrum, but it doesn't happen anywhere else. And we don't, and, you know, and we seemingly, because we've made great strides towards gender equality, that seemingly everything is fixed. I don't think it is fixed. And I think one only needs to ask the women in their lives, you know, this is men, needs to ask the women in their lives, like, what are your experiences of inequality, to hear that they're pretty vast and they manifest in different ways. And we might even contribute to that. I might contribute to that with the women in my life, you know, because I grew up in the 1990s and 2000s, and I'm, you know, conditioned by the society that I lived in then, and even the society that I live in now, where, you know, we have leaders who say things that are outwardly harmful towards women and other groups, and there's seemingly no repercussions. And so it's not possible to entirely remove ourselves from that. And it requires a degree of self-reflection, awareness, and work. And I think that we're not doing that with men and boys enough, so they don't know how to speak out. But I only think a few of them are worried about being cancelled. I think for most people, they just don't know where to start.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I totally agree there. Like, it does seem to be, like, especially like you said, from men that, you know, violence against women, like, you know, it's just the extreme end of things, but we need to realise all the varying degrees as well. And I think as well, because I've spoken to people that are survivors of domestic violence and abuse, is that men need to also realize what are some of the things that their mates say or do that could be like signs that, you know, they are a violent person. Because so often I hear, like, you know, like, say if like someone gets arrested or sentenced to prison for domestic violence or for murder of a woman, like, their friends will be like, oh, I had no idea, you know, he just seemed like such a top bloke, you know, he was the nicest guy, rah rah rah. And I just feel like when I hear stuff like that, I just think, like, was he, or was it he was just putting on a facade for you, or was it there were signs but you just didn't see the signs because you just think, oh, if he's violent against women, you know, like he doesn't, you know, harass women in the streets or anything. But that, so, you know, him making small comments that are really harmful, that's nothing. You know what I mean? So I feel like that definitely needs to be something that men need to realize. Like, you know, they need to realize the small signs that might not seem huge to them, but actually could be a contribution to something later down the track where they are violent towards women.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the spectrum of men's behavior is so important, right? Like if, you know, if there's a group of men and one or two of them are comfortable making jokes that demean women, right? Or they're comfortable in a group setting harassing a woman, right? Or catcalling a woman, and all the men around them don't take an opportunity. And it doesn't have to be in the moment. You know, there's a really important, lesson here that we don't need to call out all behavior in the moment, because often, you know, we have to account for male and, you know, male on male dynamics. That let's say we take the, you know, the quintessential Aussie scenario of being down at the pub and someone's had a bit too much to drink, and then they're engaging in behavior that is minimizing women or harassing women or whatever the case may be, and another man decides to be a hero and intervene in the moment, he could potentially be putting himself at physical harm, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's not necessarily going to be taken in the way that it's intended, right? So there are opportunities to kind of de-escalate that situation, ensure that the woman is safe, remove that man from the situation, and then address it the following day, you know? And I think that not enough of this is occurring in society, where men are really engaging with their peers to be like, hey, what's the standard that we accept in our friendship group of how we behave? And what's the, you know, what kind of men do we want to be?
So the other topic that I really want to discuss with you today is about your latest podcast that you're doing with Future Women. And firstly, just I want to say big congratulations. I said this to you before we started the interview, but the way it is constructed is just incredible, because not only does it tell personal stories of victims of domestic violence, family violence, it also is educational, so then people can look out for the signs, whether it be in their own relationship or loved ones' relationships. How was this decided? How did this conversation start between you and the team behind Future Women? Like, of how you're going to do this? Because obviously a topic like this is very, very, very difficult to do, because a lot of people listening to it could be triggered by certain topics and ways of talking about it. How was it decided that it's not only people sharing personal experiences, but also an educational podcast as well?
Firstly, I have to say, Demi, you're asking the most brilliant questions.
Oh, thank you. These are phenomenal
questions. You're asking brilliant questions. I have to definitely say that. How was it decided that we would do both? I think from my perspective, you know, and reflecting on some of the earlier conversations we've had, is that without education and without, there's, on the one hand, there's awareness raising, right? And I think awareness raising is such a strange concept, because it's like people are aware that things are bad or good, right? You know, people are aware that, you know, violence against women is bad. Like if you did a cross-section of society and said, oh, who condones violence against women? Overwhelmingly, most people would say that they don't. Right? Like 99%. No one is going to be like actively saying, oh yeah, violence against women is totally fine. Like no one's going to say that, right? But they're not going to necessarily understand how their behavior in day-to-day life can potentially support the actions of perpetrators, right? So for me, in terms of a podcast, firstly, I think podcasts are such a beautiful medium. You know, like that you can listen to them whenever, you can listen to them doing whatever. People listening to this podcast now could be doing anything in their day-to-day lives. So I think from my perspective, it was like, let's get to people in the platform that will feel, you know, most natural to them. Obviously, this content is triggering for some people. At times it was triggering for me, you know, in terms of recording. It was certainly triggering for the survivors who so openly shared their lived experience and their life. it seems almost limiting to say their story, because it's not a story for them. You know, when the women were telling, you know, when they were talking to us about what they went through, and when we interviewed them and they were telling us about attempts made on their life, for example, that's not a story. You know, they were having to relive that mentally and put themselves in a very compromising and dangerous space. So we had to ensure that we had supports in place for them to be able to make sure that they were looked after, you know, in terms of sharing that and speaking about what they have been put through and what they've endured. And I think from my perspective, it was so key that, like, we go beyond this idea of raising awareness and we go to using the power of human experience to be able to educate. You know, I think awareness raising in and of itself only goes so far. When we educate, you know, in a way that is not patronizing or condescending and does so from the perspective of, well, clearly if this is an issue of the magnitude that it is, then enough people in society aren't invested in it or know what they need to do in order for things to change or to shift. And so I think from my perspective, that was the sort of angle that I tried to take, and that we as a team tried to cultivate. That it was like, we're going in with this perspective of, we're not the experts. I'm not an expert. None of the producers are experts. No one working on this podcast is an expert. But the people who have survived abuse and violence and the people who work in the space, in the sector, they are experts, both from lived expertise and experience and from, you know, being a practitioner or a policymaker. And so it was like, teach us. Because I think a lot of content around this topic is often made by people assuming a certain degree of knowledge. And I think that that is phenomenal when it comes to upskilling and training people who work in the space. But I don't think that the average person who has 100 demands on their time is going to understand that particular level. So this is really a podcast that is aimed at everyday people living in Australia who hear about this issue or know about it or may have been, you know, experienced it either as survivors or as people concerned about their own behavior and think, well, what, you know, what can I do? What role do I play in society? And I think particularly now, because we're living in a time where we would all like to see greater government funding, greater government investment, greater, like, you know, responsibility from business and elsewhere of like systemic kind of changes and shifts. But when they're not happening, or they're happening at a pace that feels glacial, then what can we as individuals do? And that was really powerful to me. What is the individual responsibility? So, you know, for example, in the first podcast, we discuss issues around love bombing. You know, what is love bombing? What does it look like? So what are the signs, the subtle signs and precursors that lead to harms towards women? You know, we meet Laura, a survivor, and she talks about her abuser's pattern of abuse and how he built her up, you know, onto a pedestal only to devalue and dehumanize her. And then how she necessarily didn't see what was happening to her as abuse until someone from 1-800-RESPECT said to her, hey, you are in an abusive relationship. It is not your fault, and we are here to support you. And I think that's really important to understand, because we often lay blame at the feet of victim survivors when it's really the abuser who should be held responsible and accountable for their choice to use violence. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was really key. It was like, we have to make it holistic and do justice by victim survivors, but we really also have to make sure that it's it goes beyond this idea of like trauma porn or what, you know, tell us about the bad things that happened to you. Because all true crime is essentially like that. It's like just laying it out there. Whereas here, it's like, this is hopefully educational. And I think for me, it means a lot to hear from someone like yourself that it is hitting the right marks. And I hope that the episodes we continue to make really do continue in that vein and help support a greater understanding of domestic abuse and family violence in the Australian context and help educate people.
Yeah, well, it's So far, I watched the two episodes, but by the time this is released, there'll be three. But they definitely have educated me so much and definitely have resonated with me, because I have loved ones that have been in abusive relationships. And even though they may not have been in physical abusive relationships, so they're taken not as seriously, but it makes you realize, like, even if it's not physical, they are still traumatizing, they're still an abusive relationship. And yeah, I really do appreciate that when you and the team created the podcast, as you said, it's not a true crime podcast, it's not trauma porn, which I did really, really appreciate a lot. And I do have to ask as well, because as someone that has their own personal experience with domestic violence because of your sister, Nikki, how then did you take care of yourself during this process? Because I can imagine it would have been triggering hearing these people's stories, hearing these survivors' stories, and you trying to not let, I'm just trying to imagine, like, what that must have been like for you, because you yourself would have heard stories from Nikki. Was there any time when their stories, like, crossed over and you thought like, oh my God, that's kind of like what Nikki would say?
All the time, Demi.
Yeah.
All the time. It was and there were experiences in, you know, when we heard from these women, for me, listening back, it was sort of this really strange experience of, wow, Nikki would have gone through similar or the same. And what, it was strange because there was obviously such deep sorrow when I heard that, but also a sense of hope that, you know, some of these survivors were able to leave abusive relationships. They are safe now, or they feel safe now, and they say that they feel safe now. So it was at times confronting, but ultimately inspiring and hopeful, you know? And I think one of the things for me is, and this is what makes me most sad, is Nikki's life was taken from her. You know, often the way that we frame domestic abuse and family violence, and particularly intimate partner homicide, is this very abstract terms, you know? Like we say, like, women lost, you know, women lose their lives, etc. But they have their lives taken from them. They're killed. It's you know, it's quite often a deliberate act, you know, or an escalating pattern of abuse that ends with murder. And so it was really, really, like, confronting at times. And I found that difficult. I found that really difficult. But also it was filled with this sense of hope. And I was always consistently inspired by these women who would tell stories of such harrowing experience and do so in such great detail, yet also with such humility and grace as to say that, like, this is what would help other people, you know. And survivors don't owe anyone anything. You know, if you've experienced what you have as a survivor, you don't owe anyone anything, right? So for them to so graciously share from such a place of trauma and pain and relive that, I think it's a genuine privilege. So that was not lost on me, right? That they are doing that. And I think for everyone who listens to There's No Place Like Home, they will certainly feel that, or I hope that they feel that sense of gratitude to victim survivors who don't owe anyone anything, but are telling us where we as a society failed them so we don't fail others. And you asked me about looking after myself. I think this was very much a case of, like, do as I say, not as I do, because I don't think I did the best job at times. I think it's quite immersive, and I wasn't necessarily as on top of all of my self-care practices. I certainly gravitated towards some of the self-care practices that aren't necessarily the best. So, for example, you know, ordering and eating an entire large pizza, comfort food, stuff like that, when really a session with my psychologist would have been far more in order. But it was and is a process. You know, we're still working on the podcast behind the scenes as each episode is rolled out. And it was a process where we collectively, the whole team, have to look after ourselves and check in with each other. And I think Future Women in particular, and Jamila Rizvi and others who've worked on it, Sally Spicer is one of the producers, and Ella Jackson as well, we've created a space of trust around each other. And we've created an environment without hierarchy, where we are working collectively with a shared vision. And the shared vision is that victim survivors' voices must be the center of the story. You know, so in working on this podcast, it is essential that their experience is told in the way that they want it to be told. So for example, a lot of podcasts, and listeners may not know this, but a lot of podcasts are often recorded in such a way that the subjects or the interviewees are interviewed and then that's it, right? And then they don't know how the edit's going to be. Mm. Here, victim survivors, and we made a conscious thing that we would include them at every stage of the process, so they hear everything before it goes out to the public, because that is the kind of thing that I found when Nikki was murdered and news media would interview my family. They would interview me, or they would try to interview my parents. And my dad didn't want to speak to the media, but my mom, did speak to the media. And then afterwards she would say things like, oh, they just took this little grab of me and I do wish they didn't put that out there. But all of a sudden that's, on the national news. And there's that saying in media, if it bleeds, it leads, right? So it made the news. It wasn't like something buried off, way into the corner. It was something that made news. And so my mum would feel heartbroken that not only has her only daughter been killed, now the media reporting is using her words in such a way that she feels disrespects the memory of her daughter or the meaning of what she was trying to say. And so there was a feeling of being used or abused or disrespected. And I think that here, it was really important to the whole team that we do right by victim survivors, because they don't, fundamentally, they don't owe anyone anything. So it was like, if they're going to share their lived experience, then the very least that we can do is try to make it so that it is respectful, it is honest, it is authentic to how they want that to be told.
And you all did that so, so well. And I definitely just can see that there was just so many hours and revisions and just making the episodes be the best that they could possibly be. Like it wasn't a half-assed job, like when I listened to the episodes. So I definitely would recommend Nasty Woman Club listeners to give the podcast a listen, because it's definitely something that's, even though the podcasting landscape is so massive now these days, there's a topic on everything and anything right now. But this podcast, though, is very, very, very different. And it just does it in a way that, I don't think any other podcast has before. So big congratulations on it, because it's just brilliant.
No, thank you, Demi. And you know what's really cool is something that one of the producers sent to me was that in the first week, the podcast that we've made actually cracked the top 100 charts or something.
Oh, yeah.
And it actually placed one spot above Kyle and Jackie O, which I thought was fantastic. Yes. because Kyle is known for having his, tantrums and really behaving in a way that is problematic. Given the size of his platform, he could really behave in a way where other men took a lead from his behavior. And he doesn't always meet that threshold, I think, of what we want to see in terms of men who are in public life. Mm-hmm. And so having a podcast about domestic abuse and family violence that tries to be kind of first person telling the story of someone while also being educational, placing just one above Kyle and Jackie O, in particular Kyle, I was just like, it's like a moment of quiet achievement, that if nothing else, like if no one listens to this, if no one ever listens to this, I will feel happy. Like I could die tomorrow and be like, yeah, I did something good.
Yes, I love it. Yes, yeah. Bit of a slap in the face for Kyle. We love that. Yes. So to finish off today's episode, hopefully on a bit of a lighter note, every single episode of the Nasty Woman Club, my guest and myself, we share our highlights and lowlights of the week, our best and worst, our, it could be the smallest of things, the biggest of things, achievements, or just annoyances from the week. So we're going to start on a low point, so then we can finish on a high point. So what was your low light of the week?
I think the low light of the week for me is the kind of state of affairs we're living in, right? Like whether it's flooding occurring across Australia and sort of an absent political response from federal leadership,
yep.
That's certainly a low light for me. A massive low light is, of course, the invasion of Ukraine that's occurring by Putin and Russian army. It feels disrespectful to say by Russia, because it's like the people of Russia seem, you know, many of them, at least according to the footage that I've seen, to not actually want this invasion. They do not support it. There are protests occurring within Russia itself around, you know, the Putin's actions. And generally, you know, in some of the reporting around what's happening in Ukraine seems to be a low light. The way that people who are of, you know, European appearance, i.e. blonde hair, blue eyes, white skin, are seen and counted as genuine refugees, or that they are part of, you know, war-torn countries or war-ravaged regions. Not understanding that war has been going on in other parts of the world throughout the last, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, and yet that doesn't receive the same level of attention. And it's sort of disappointing for me, because yes, absolutely, we should care for what's happening in Ukraine. And we should also care about what's happening in other parts of the world. You know, and I think that hopefully this serves as a reminder and a lesson about the sanctity of all human life. So that's been a low light for me this week. What about you, Demi?
My low light, definitely with Ukraine. I think that's definitely hit a lot of people these past couple of weeks. And yeah, as you said, the reporting has just been disgusting, and there is so much racism, not just in the reporting, but also in the fact that particular refugees, if they are of a certain color, it affects how easy they can get into other countries, which is just, it's just disgusting that that is still happening. But again, not surprising. But I think my big low light of the week would have to be the floods happening in Queensland right now. I am based in Brisbane. Horrible. And I have a lot of friends and family that are in flooded areas. And my poor Nana and my poor Pop, their farm has been flooded, and they were affected by the 2011 floods. And I remember going out to the farmhouse after the floods came through, and I don't think people understand, like, the smell of the mud after it's been, like, sitting there and it's been pushed through, and you could just, every single bit of dirt, animal, anything has been in that water, and then it's just this thick mud. The smell is just awful, and just trying to get that out of houses and just the smallest of things.
Flood, yeah. And you don't see, like, you can't see that through the television, right? You just see like flooding and then some of the news reporting on that as well is like going for, like, almost making light of the situation. Like when they were showing a cow on top of a roof, and it was like, aha, look, it's a cow on a roof. And it's like, no, a cow has actually found its way onto the roof to not die, because that the flood waters are so high. Like, the cow would rather be on land. Like, so would everyone else who's on roofs. They would rather be on land. And
yeah,
it's not footage,
funny. They don't want to be there. Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost like this strange voyeuristic thing that's happening. Which has been really, really disturbing and unsettling.
Yeah. I've seen, because I've just been having to watch a lot of press conferences and stuff like that. And a lot of reportings, and it's so frustrating because the other day I was watching this reporter and he was standing in front of this flooded area and there was all these kids just on paddleboards in the flooded water. And the man's like, you know, trying to say like, oh, stay in your homes, you know, it's dangerous outside. And then he's like awkwardly being like, oh, but these kids here, oh, that there's parents there. It's okay. These parents are there. But it's like, so often I've seen this these reports of like, and footage of people in the floodwaters and dangerous, dangerous floodwaters that are like dark brown. You don't know what's in the water. Like there's animals that could be in there. There could even be bodies because already 9 people have died. You never know. There could be bodies in there. And yeah, it's just really frustrating seeing all this footage of people just having a good old time. Just, yeah, going kayaking, going boogie boarding, just stand up paddle boarding. It's just, I understand people are trying to use humor to get through this traumatic event because I myself definitely use humor. Like I love to create a good meme when there's like, you know, something frustrating happening, but I don't know. I just feel like it's a dangerous, dangerous thing to be just making fun of floodwaters. Like you can so easily be taken by them. And
Yeah, exactly. Mm. That reminds me actually of something, a trend that I've seen sort of on TikTok recently, which also fits into this low light, is that there are people who are using nuclear bomb simulators on Australian cities. And they're like, what would happen if, say, Brisbane was nuked by Russia? Or what would happen? People in the UK are doing it. What would happen if London was nuked? And then they would take like the biggest size bomb in the simulator and then they would go through the scenario, knowing full well that there is close to, I could, you know, hand on heart, say there is a 0% chance that Putin is going to drop a bomb, a nuclear bomb, on any Australian city anytime soon. We're not, you know, we're not involved in what is happening there in an active sense, right? So that is not going to happen. And the novelty of it is sort of intriguing to people, but it is also terrifying a lot of people, particularly say in the UK, for example, where there are people terrified because they don't understand, you know, that this is unlikely to occur, but there are people who are preying on fears and insecurities. And I just find that in the context of what's going on a little bit reckless, you know, and I'd watch that first one, you know, about Melbourne. And I watched on with this kind of morbid curiosity and I watched the entire video and I thought about it and I was like, wow, nuclear bombs can do this. And then I thought about it more and I was like, man, I don't know. That makes me feel uncomfortable. I don't think that's what we should be doing in this situation. But what you were saying about the way that the reporting in Brisbane has been occurring and the way people are sort of showing it in this way that's like making light of the situation, I think that's happening with a lot of world events, and this is just one example of that as well.
Yeah.
What are your highlights this week? I want to know what your highlights are.
My highlights. Well, so a couple of weeks ago, my beautiful dog Dolce passed away. I've had her for 15 years, and that was just so, so horrible. And
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. And I just missed having just this little thing just like following me. The house just felt so, so quiet. So my partner and I have been looking into fostering some animals because there are a lot of animals right now that need fostering, especially in the Brisbane area with the floodings. And yeah, we've been able to foster a puppy, which has just been great.
Amazing.
And he's just the most beautiful little thing. So yeah, that's definitely been my highlight. That's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. My highlight was, there's a few things. Mm-hmm. One is, you know, the flip side of the situation in Ukraine and the invasion by Russia is seeing everyone band together. And seeing particularly the footage that is coming out of Ukraine. So, for example, when, you know, there was some footage that made news here in the West of some Russian soldiers asking Ukrainian soldiers to drop arms, otherwise that they were going to attack, and they told them to go fuck themselves.
Yes. That was,
I don't know. It feels uncomfortable saying that was a highlight, but it genuinely was, because it was just like, wow, you know, they're really like, they're not giving in easily. They're not surrendering. Another highlight in that vein.
And they survived. I just found out today.
They survived. They survived.
Oh, that makes me so happy.
And another highlight for me is seeing in the context of this invasion, that President Zelensky of Ukraine, when he was asked to, you know, when he was asked, or rather told by President Biden, that we have a way to get you out safely, knowing that he is the number one target, really, so that they can take over Kiev, the capital, and then take over Ukraine. When he said, I don't need a ride, I need anti-tank ammunition, and then he put on a bulletproof vest and held a rifle. And I obviously, neither one of us condones violence whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But the idea of a head of state actually fighting for their country, that has not happened in many, many generations. There are, you know, war is often young people dying because of old men's power and greed.
Yep.
Right? Uh-huh. And so seeing a leader of a country alongside his or her or their citizens taking the fight, that to me really spoke volumes about integrity of character and leadership. You know, and that's why it's a highlight. It's not the act of being in the war, because war is horrible, but it's the act of saying, I'm not going to abandon those people who look to me for leadership. And, you know, I can't see leaders in other countries doing anything remotely like that. I can't see leaders in our country doing anything like that, Demi, that they would actually stand side by side with their country people if shit hit the fan. You know, and that them doing that,
they would just go to Hawaii.
Yeah, touche. So I think that really spoke volumes to me around the situation in Ukraine, and was sort of it's not a silver lining, but was sort of a reminder about how people really do care. You know, and there are leaders who care as well. You know, often I think in Australia we look further afield to New Zealand in one of our closest neighbors to see a leader who genuinely appears to care about the people and about the progress of the nation and some of the nation's most disadvantaged groups. So I think that, you know, that was a reminder that there are good leaders out there and that there are people in positions of power who do care. We don't always get that reminder here in Australia. So I think that was nice. The other highlight for me was really the launch of the podcast. The launch of the podcast, there was you know, a lot of media around that, a lot of uptake around that, And I think for me, that experience was really positive, that people responded to the podcast well. And we've put in, as a team, you know, hours and hours and hours of work, and just having that received in the way that it has been intended has been really positive. You know, that is a definite highlight for me. And then the other highlight was I went to Sydney for the podcast. You know, I spent a couple of days up there. And when I got back, my dog Habibi like just bolted to the front door. Aww. As soon as I opened the door, she ran from the living room straight up to give me a cuddle. And every time I step outside, even if it's just to go to the supermarket and come back, she will always bolt down the hallway and just, you know, want to give me all the cuddles, all the licks. And it's just like, yeah, it's just a reminder of living in the present and that, you know, no matter what happens, dogs are incredible and amazing. Yes. And we love them. And so for me, yeah, that's probably my highlight all the time, every week, is just the unconditional love of the pet family member or members.
Yeah, pets just, honestly, they just make every day, make every week just like 10 times better just with their beautiful face. And they just, I think it's because they just look at us like we're like this godlike thing that has just like made their life 10 times more amazing. It's just like, no, you don't realize you make my life more amazing. It's just, it's just beautiful. Yeah.
They really do.
Yeah. Well, big, big thank you for coming on to today's podcast. I've been wanting to talk to you for so, so long, and I'm so glad I finally had the guts to message you and be like, come on the show. So
no, thank you. Thank you for reaching out. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, and thank you so much for having me. And I hope that everything is safe in Brisbane for you and your loved ones. It's horrible what's happening there. And from Melbourne, certainly my thoughts are with you all.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you everyone so much for tuning into today's episode of the Nasty Woman Club podcast. Before you do anything, before you click pause and go on to your next show, highly, highly recommend that you all check out Terang's latest podcast with Future Women called There's No Place Like Home. I did speak highly of it in the episode interview, but that is not enough. It's far, far more incredible, educational, and eye-opening than I could ever put into words. And Terang and his team have just done an incredible job putting this together. So I would highly recommend you go check it out. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts, do it immediately. And if you're not already, please be sure to follow my guests on their Instagram page. I will make sure to leave Terang's Instagram handle in the show notes. Anyway, that is it for today's episode of the Nasty Woman Club podcast. I greatly appreciate you all for tuning in, and I will see you all next week. I'm your host, Demi Lynch. Stay nasty, everyone. We at the Nasty Woman Club pay our respects to the traditional custodians of the Meanjin land. We acknowledge that we are on the stolen lands of the Yarraga and Turrbal people, whose sovereignty was never ceded. This land is, and always will be, Aboriginal land.